Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman. Heidi Helfand, welcome to the Exagility podcast. How are you doing today?
Hi, John. Doing well. How are you?
Very good, thank you. I'm really very interested to interview you about this book, Dynamic Reteaming. We're an audio, of course, and so people will have to build kind of an audio picture of what we're going to be talking about. But lovely cover in the book, the different colors giving off diversity, signals of diversity. And you had forewords from two very prominent people, John Cutler and Diana Larson, I noticed. How did you manage to do that? I think I noticed that you worked with John Cutler, but where did you meet John? And I guess, how did you come across Diana as well, Heidi?
John and I worked together maybe three-ish years at one of the startups that I write about in the book called AppFolio. We were teammates, and I was an agile coach at the time, or director of agile coaching or something, and he was on the UX team. And yeah, we're friends and built a relationship over the years. And Diana Larson, at one point in time, we were talking and she offered to write a foreword. So I'm very grateful for both of these people, John and Diana, for supporting my work and writing the forewords.
And is it correct, Heidi, that the initial version of the book was put out on Leanpub and then you got a publisher later on for the second edition?
Yes, that's correct.
That's really cool. I don't hear of that happening so often. That's really nice that that happened.
Yeah, the strategy was suggested to me by Joshua Kirievsky. Write the book that you want to write and then find a publisher. And that really worked for me because I got to take my time with the book. I found Leanpub as a way to get ideas out there and write in public. And after a while, I pitched it to a few different publishers. And one thing led to another, and I published the second edition with O'Reilly. It's different than the first version.
And what were the key differences, Heidi, would you say? The pandemic, I guess, would be one consideration.
Yeah, the pandemic is one consideration. Chapter 13, is it 13? Yeah, chapter 13 about planning dynamic reteaming initiatives and what to do after your teams change, like a variety of practical team reset ideas, team calibrations. I wrote that specifically for some of the teams that I was coaching at a different startup. And the book is, when you're self-publishing a book, I had an editor at one point, kind of editor proofreader, but with O'Reilly, I had partners that really helped me refine the book, narrow it down. So there are a handful of differences for sure.
And I'd imagine that a lot of content gets cut as well when you work with a publisher because they want you to do it in a particular style. Was that your experience?
I feel like it's just a lot more refined transitions. Yeah. Chapters, introducing images in a particular way. So there were stylistic things, and I feel like it really just made a better final product.
Nice. It's really cool that happened. I'm looking at your book and I loved reading the book. It was very easy to read it. It was something I could sit down, I could read it for a couple of hours, put it down, pick it back up, read it for another couple of hours. It was the interlacing of stories and theory I found really useful. And you didn't let it go that long before you brought in some examples. And there was like nearly every page were examples. So I really enjoyed that. And I was pleasantly surprised as well when I read it. I was expecting good things anyhow. But I was really pleasantly surprised by some of the content. And so one of the things that was troubling me was what is a team? And that's one of the topics that you took head on in the book, because a lot of the time I see people and they're in a group, if you like, but they're not really caring about each other's work. And I'm just wondering, is that something that you've come across as well, Heidi, in distinguishing maybe a group of people from a team? Or was that something that ever bothered you?
I don't know if it bothered me. I noticed that, I mean, in my career, sometimes groups, which are maybe people working across different teams, but then they come together like a community of practice, they might call themselves a team. And I think it's a way that they use that word to build camaraderie.
Yeah.
They might not be working on the same things. They might not be working with the same people, but they might have things in common and they might want to form a community. So they might use the word team. Whereas they are technically a group by whatever definition you might pick for group versus team. I think I have one in here. I don't remember what where it was from. It's been a little while since I wrote this book. In other cases, when people are working on shared work, like thought partners, maybe they're pairing and working on something together. Maybe they're writing something together. You could think of them as a team. So they have some sort of shared goal, shared work of some kind.
Yeah. Okay. That's something that I noticed, some kind of North Star that they're going after, and they care about it together, almost like the common enemy, if you like. I don't like to use a war metaphor, but there's alignment in terms of people want to work together to achieve something. And in the last few years, what I've noticed is the kind of proliferation of the word squad, for example, and the interchanging of the word squad with team. And I've also seen a reference as well in the EU Field Guide for Managing Complexity in a Crisis by Dave Snowden. They talked about crews as well. So in a crew, you could have really skilled people. For example, let's say Jordy is in a fire crew and he's a fire engine driver. He drives the fire engine and he's deeply trained in that. And then when Mary comes along to replace Jordy, there's immediate trust because Mary has been just as intensively trained as Jordy on doing the driving of this specialist equipment. And so the whole notion of squads, teams, crews is something that's been on my mind for the last few years. And I'm curious if that's something that propped up in your mind as well, Heidi.
I've witnessed teams call themselves squads, and it's just a word that's used interchangeably with team.
Yeah.
The word crew, I've never encountered a team in my experience that use the word crew, but they can if they would like. People use words in different ways.
Yeah. And at the start of your book, you talked about the evolution of teams and you use the EcoCycle map, which is a really nice tool to use. I use it quite a lot if I'm working with change agents and we're trying to figure out, are we getting a bit stuck in our ways kind of thing? So there's usually stop at the top. Imagine everyone listening, imagine a number 8 side was like an infinity sign. And there's the maturity, the top right corner, you know, what you're good at. And hopefully we're good at some things and we've really reached maturity in those. And then there's the rigidity trap, which is you become so set in your ways that actually you're stuck in a rut, really. And then to get out of that, people would go to the bottom of the right-hand side, which would be like creative destruction. What do I need to stop doing to make space for what I want to do next? So, for example, when I became a Scrum Master all those years ago, I decided to do creative destruction on IT operations management and project management, because I deleted all those things actually out of my CV. So the agencies wouldn't be calling me with jobs in those areas because I didn't want to do that work anymore. So I creatively destructed that. And then BERT on the top left is about what am I starting? What seeds am I planting? And then hopefully if you put enough energy into that, that gets to germination or adolescence in terms of we've developed it a little bit. It hasn't matured, but there's signs that this could grow into something lovely. But an even more sad trap is the poverty trap, which it doesn't really mean that you're poor financially. It could mean that, but it's usually that there's something that you started. You went to all the trouble of stopping doing something to make space for something. Then you started something, like, for example, writing a book. And then you didn't put enough energy into it. So it never really happened. It never even got off the ground. And that's even more sad to me. The poverty trap is more sad to me than the rigidity trap, because you went to all that effort and you still got nowhere. And then it goes up in and around. It's like a number 8. And there should be really good energy, because if there's flow through maturity, creative destruction, birth and adolescence, it's a sign that there's learning going on, that there's improvement happening and things and so on. And I was really encouraged to see that you use this for teams, because I used to use this for individuals. And I'm curious, Heidi, how you got the idea to do this and maybe where you first tried it.
Yeah. So I was at a Liberating Structures immersion event in Brussels, Belgium. And I was getting exposed to different Liberating Structures patterns. And they introduced the EcoCycle in terms of work. So you can model a team's work, which work is in the birth phase, which work is in maturity, which work is in adolescence. And there was an activity that goes along with it. It's called EcoCycle planning. And as I thought more and more about that, I thought, wow, where is that from? Because it's not initiated by, maybe the activity applying it to work is initiated by the Liberating Structures community, but where is the primary source? And I was reading the book called Panarchy, which they reference, by Gunderson and Holling, where they use this ecocycle as a metaphor that can be applied to a lot of different things. Forestry is an example that I talk about when I give talks about this, to introduce the ecocycle with kind of a tangible nature example. And as I was thinking about some of the ideas in my book, I don't remember what year it was. It might have been 2018 or 2017 when this happened. I was just, my mind was blown when thinking about teams that grow larger. If you think of a team in like a birth phase, or a team that's starting, and then the team adds people and grows and grows, and you can get to a larger size. And sometimes you can be in sort of a rigidity trap. Things are unrelated. Work is becoming unrelated. It's harder to make decisions. There's so many people. Things take longer. And then at some point, the grow and split pattern happens, and the team breaks itself up into two or three pieces, and then they become new teams. So the creative destruction is this change, this reteaming that happens from the big team to smaller teams. Could be two, could be three. Sometimes, a lot of the times with this grow and split type pattern, it's the people that decide that maybe something needs to change, and hey, why don't we try changing our team composition? And then they go through that creative destruction, they figure out how they're going to change, and then they start again. So they go through renewal up to the top left of the ecocycle again, and then essentially the two or more teams are in the birth phase again, they're starting over. So then maybe they calibrate or recalibrate or have a reset, and then they go on their journey through time again. So teams evolve and change. And I think the ecocycle is a really powerful metaphor and lens just to make sense of what happens when teams go through transformations like this.
Indeed, it's a very powerful model. There's another one as well that I've used as well before, the Tuckman model. And I was a bit nervous about the Tuckman model because I heard that someone debunked it. But then recently, the Oxford Review reviewed the Tuckman model, forming, storming, norming, performing, and I think adjourning. I can't remember what the last step was. And it was really interesting that they studied the studies and how many papers cited it and so on. And they found, 70-odd papers criticizing it. And then they really whittled it down to maybe 11 key papers that were criticizing the Tuckman model. And then they actually found that 10 of them actually agreed with the Tuckman model. They just hadn't read the paper properly from 1965. And then there was one remaining one, which was a kind of a military-oriented case study, which had its own flaws, apparently, because people who were going through this program, imagine you're in the military and you're mid-career, and you go to this program and they assess you on how good you are at teamwork. So no surprises for guessing who's going to admit that they're going to have problems with their teamwork, right? Not many people are going to admit it. So there's a flaw already in the study. And they weren't together for long enough every day to be a team, really. And they were using projects, and the projects were so short that they weren't long enough to see the storming that you might normally see with a team. So it was interesting that the one paper that they found was criticizing Tuckman was flawed in itself. So the conclusion was that we can't say Tuckman is valid, but we can't say it's invalid. It's like all models are wrong, you know, some are useful kind of thing. So it's interesting how you use that as well, but I quite like the way you've used the ecocycle map, because it's independent of all of that as well. And it kind of makes sense to people. It makes sense that there would be natural energy and things developing and growing, just like life, like the circle of life, really, isn't it? So in terms of dynamic reteaming, when was the first time that you realized, Heidi, that this is something that might be needed, that this whole concept of dynamic reteaming, that it might even be needed? Because a lot of the world would have been saying, until you came along, oh, we need stable teams and it's the best way. And you got people like Richard Hackman, who did loads of research on that, and teams get better over time. And except there's one kind of glitch, all right, that for teams who do R&D, the performance falls off a cliff after 4 years and nobody understands why, but they just understand that happens. But usually when you stand up at a talk, you really start very nicely. You say, who here has had someone change in the team in the last month? And almost everybody stands up. And then you say, actually, when anybody is added or removed from a team, you've got a new team. So what triggered you to think that you should interview people to figure out whether this was a thing and whether this is something that needed to be developed?
I have been a part of successful startups for 20 years. The first one, I was an early employee, like 15th employee. I left when there were about 800. We invented GoToMeeting, GoToWebinar. Successful company, got acquired a couple of times. Second startup I was at, I was the 10th employee, left when there were 600. AppFolio, property management company, went public, I believe, June 2015. Around then, I just, as you grow and change as a fast-growing company, you're not on the same team forever. So I just had this realization that, wait a minute, we weren't doing it wrong. These are successful companies that continued to grow and change through the years. And I just, as I thought about it more, I really wanted to dig into that. And then I was like, was it only us? And then I started interviewing people worldwide and wrote about the patterns that emerged from my experience and from the conversations. There was a larger number of patterns, but got things down to 5 base patterns. So they were derived from the data that I collected, qualitative research. So I'd interview people, I'd transcribe the data, I'd code the data for themes, and I was simply writing about what the data said. And it's really like an anthropology. It's really just a study of what teams are like in the software industry, what many teams are like. And I think having practitioner voices is important. You're citing a lot of different studies and papers and all of that. And I think that's great too. This is a book written about experience and other people's experiences. And it's just a descriptive piece that has a second section at the back of, all right, sometimes change is going to happen to you. Sometimes your teams are going to change, whether you like it or not. People are going to join. People are going to leave. Sometimes reorgs happen. Unfortunately, sometimes layoffs happen. It's either going to be out of your control, or maybe you're going to be in a position where you want to generate some kind of change, or you want to see a change happen. So there's tactics for both cases. And it's a challenging topic. Managing organizational change and team change is no easy thing to do. It's very difficult. And so I became more and more curious about the topic and wrote about it and give practical ideas for people that are involved in this. So
I really appreciate that, all the interviews that you did across quite a range of companies. And one of the things I've noticed in the Power of Team Assignment chapter, you basically describe some patterns that you've noticed in terms of when teams get set up. And so one of them was like someone at the top put people on the team. Another one was the manager decides who's in the team. And there was another one, the people take a survey to see if they want to change teams, which is a bit more kind of opt-in. And managers encourage people to volunteer for a team, which is, yeah, it's interesting. And then there's managers arrange team self-selection events. So that's more about people deciding themselves that the managers are involved. And then even more deeply than that, teams strategize and form their own structures. So not only are they self-designing, but they're self-governing as well. So different levels of self-management there in your book. And what I see a lot, particularly when someone comes along with some scaling framework of the month or whatever, and they say, okay, you're all going to be in these teams, and people are basically told they're going to be on those teams. I'd love to see situations where people have more of a say in terms of what happens. What do you see happening most often, Heidi? What's the most common thing that you've observed? And what's been the best experience that you've observed?
In my career, I've seen a lot of the fit operation that I write about in the book, where there's a need for people on a team and managers talk to people that report to them. And they try to, through process of mutual selection, try to staff their teams. I think also what you see a lot of the times is that people are joining a story that's in progress. Somebody joined your company. Maybe you're hiring for a particular team. Maybe you're hiring and then you place people in a team. So it's, you might see a variety of things.
And what I noticed as well in the chapter, Reducing Risk and Encouraging Sustainability, this was a kind of a nice surprise to me that you're proposing dynamic reteaming as a way of kind of de-risking the bus factor, really. So the bus factor, how many people need to be knocked down before we're kind of in trouble as a company. So the higher that number, the better, because more people have skills in that particular thing, so we can carry on. So the whole notion of the bus counter, the bus factor is not new in software, but might be new in some other areas. And you propose that actually dynamic retaining as a way of facilitating learning, which I really get. And I hadn't thought about that before I read the book, actually, that my misunderstanding before I read the book was that maybe retaining is for kind of moving people around so that if there's a particular type of work that needs a particular type of skill, people get moved around like deck chairs in the Titanic kind of thing. And we need to move that way. Oh, we need to move that way. And the right people move kind of thing. But actually, you're proposing it as a way of learning. And I'd love to hear more about that, Heidi. And could you tell us a couple of stories about how people have learned new skills through dynamic retaining?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's nice when people have options and they see opportunities in their companies to learn something new. And I remember quite vividly a software engineer that I worked with at AppFolio. And it was back in the day where I think AWS was very young and we built our own data centers instead for this particular company. And there was a software engineer who really wanted to learn about data center management and how we're failing over with the different data centers that we had and more on the hardware side. And yeah. So we facilitated a change where he could join that team so he could continue to learn and grow. So I loved that. And so that's one example. Another example, I've worked with people that wanted to dig into accounting type work. And they weren't on those teams before. And so they did that. So you could go and find the topic that you want to join. I've worked with other examples where people really just want to work with different people. There's a story in there. Kamran Sitari, one of the software engineers I worked with, when we had set AppFolio and AppFolio was a startup, we were one team and then we broke into two teams and we started a third team. And there was a feeling of loss between some of the engineers who were together on the first team and they would pair, program and switch pairs. But then they were separated eventually into three different teams. And there was that feeling of, wait, I want to work over here with this other person, but we're not on the same team anymore. And so the engineers together devised a switching pattern from one team to the next. And it was only so that they could get reunited and they could be thought partners and work together more closely. And it wasn't like they didn't see each other in the office. We were co-located and I think there were probably 30 people or less across all of the teams. It wasn't like it was really huge and it wasn't like they couldn't have lunch together, but they wanted to be together in that thought work. And so switching in order to foster that, I think, is important. And I think we learn from each other. And then sometimes we learn when we follow the content. Sometimes we learn when different content comes to us. So I think building the organization with flexibility is important. And then I would also like to say, and it's touching on the question you asked before that question, which was related to building resilience in teams. And what I find a lot lately is that, especially in the industry now where you have a lot of people switching across companies, that it benefits us to have larger communities of people together in the form of a team and have larger teams. So then if people leave, your whole team doesn't destruct. So it benefits us to have some larger structures, maybe communities of people merging teams together and then enabling people to organize how they want in order to attain their work objectives. So that's another thing that I see a lot. I've experienced that in three different companies. Just have more options when you have larger teams.
Yeah, I think I noticed it at several occasions during the book, this reference to pairing and swarming and people. So even though people are in teams, that they were pairing, that you had a pair kind of thing. Yeah. And Joel Justice talks about that as well when he talked about Agile at Tesla and now Agile at SpaceX, the whole idea of mobbing, swarming, pairing to learn. Did you get much resistance to that, Heidi? This whole concept of people pairing, swarming, how popular were those ideas?
It really depends on who you ask. When I was at the second startup I was at, it was by design that we paired from the start. And as more people joined, there were different feelings about pairing. People didn't necessarily want to pair 100% of the time. You can't force it on people. Yeah. You invite it like other changes. But this was very much in the foundation of this company. At one point, it was really like, why aren't you pairing? And it was like a problem if people weren't pairing. And there was a lot of dissatisfaction at one point. And once we relaxed our pairing rules that the software engineers wrote the guidelines for pairing, then we found that just natural pairing happened when it made sense. So I think it's nice to give people freedom to determine how they work. Sometimes they might want to pair. Sometimes, you know, people like to work in groups. There's certain workplaces, Hunter Industries, where they mob 100% of the time or ensemble programming. Other examples in the book, like Menlo Innovations, where they pair 100% of the time and switch pairs. Mm-hmm. I think when you're joining those companies, it's part of the interview process. You know what you're getting into. So there's that sort of expectation setting. But I think it's nice to give people a variety, and they just want to be respectful of people. I think it comes down to that.
Yeah, I agree. I'm in a team at the moment, and I'm a developer on the team, if you like. I do coaching and two clients, and I'm a developer and a team and another client. And basically, sometimes we swarm, sometimes we mob, and sometimes we pair. Sometimes we work on our own because of time zones and stuff. Mm-hmm. Or we just want to, maybe we don't know how to do something. We just want to do some research, not waste time in front of others. Just spend a few hours researching, then come back. And so we're switching between those. But every time I worked with other people, I really felt like my brain opened up. And I felt really focused as well.
Yeah, I think there's just tighter feedback loops when you're working with someone. Let's say you're writing something together, you're coding together.
Yeah.
Some people really like that. I think some people feel like their energy is really drained when they do that for too long. But I do like the kind of redundancy that it affords. I like the idea that more than one person knows the area, so that if someone wants to go work in a different part of the company, you're not left with no one to cover that area. So there's definite benefits to individuals who, maybe if you're the only owner of a system and you're working there forever and it's just you, it's going to be harder for you to switch to something else within the company unless you bring more people along for the ride. I think it always helps to have more than one person working in a system, knowing a system, just for the engineer who you might just want to learn something else or do something else. I think it's a bit safer for the company as well. I think I like it for that sort of built-in redundancy. And people might leave. Maybe they, for whatever reason, they're changing careers. They're having a pandemic epiphany and they decide that they're going to open up a restaurant instead of work at the software company. And so it's always nice to have more than one person who knows a system.
That's a really nice way of looking at it. And that touches on another question that I had from a very senior leader in a fast-moving consumer goods company. And she said, I have these technical specialists and it takes at least 2 years to learn the skills this person has. And we introduced the ideas of pairing, and some people who were paired with one person in particular, they did acquire some skills over a year, but it was felt the progress wasn't enough. I'm sure the progress was fine. It was more probably lack of patience than anything else. Have you seen people like pushing back and saying, you know, no, I need to stay in my silo. I need to stay in my box, stay in my lane, because this thing is so specialized. We need to stay here, pairing, mobbing, swarming. It's just not going to work. We just have to live with the bus number. Is that something that you've come across?
I've come across personal preference that people don't want to change. And
yeah,
that's fine. I haven't come across an example like you're saying where someone is like, I can be the only one forever. No, I have not encountered that.
Yeah, thank you. You mentioned some patterns in the book. One of them is one by one, which I guess is what it says on the tin. You switch people one at a time. And then you've got grow and split, which is a nice way of basically saying you grow a team. And then when it gets to a particular size, you split the team. And there's different ways of growing and splitting the team. And then there was a pattern called isolation pattern, which I found very interesting because I found it very similar to Michael Sahota's culture bubble, where essentially maybe for some temporary initiative, you give people some kind of isolation from all the bureaucracy of the company, and they're kind of given a bit more freedom to do things. And then you have the merging pattern, which I guess is like the opposite of that, where they've been isolated away and now you're kind of merging them back in. It could also be because of some merger and acquisition, I guess, of some merging happening that way. And then there's a switching pattern, which you've already mentioned. The isolation pattern, Heidi, how often have you seen that?
Multiple times in my career. There's a story in the book about the first startup I was at, and I was on the web development team, and we were going to change the world. We were building a marketplace where people could provide tech support and see and operate your computer to solve tech support problems. We loved that product and had a lot of hopes and dreams for it as a web development team, a lot of features we wanted to add. And there was only one problem. Nobody wanted to buy it. So the company had to pivot. And so there was a small team formed off to the side. I was part of that team. We were given process freedom. We didn't have to follow the waterfall ways of working that the company had until that point in time. We were able to have tighter feedback loops and faster feedback loops and work how we wanted. We didn't have to wait for pixel perfect mockups. And we wound up, it was a pivot in the startup. We created a product called Go to My PC, where people could see and control their computers from a distance.
Yeah.
And it became more successful than we did the many-to-many version with GoToMeeting and then GoToWebinar. So thinking back, that was one of the first times that I experienced that as a team member. Nobody called it the isolation pattern. I named it that when I was writing this book. Mm-hmm. Second startup, when we were building the second product that we had, felt very inappropriate to work in 2-week sprint cycles. It was way too slow. The team had to work in faster cycles. And it's really this mismatch of cycles. It felt like the work was unrelated. You needed a different team anyway, and giving people process freedom. They worked in more of hourly, couple hour long sprints. They worked in iterations. And so that one deliberately, both of these, like the management was like, don't bother this team. They're doing something different. And had freedom to just work differently. And yeah, those are a couple personal experiences that I've had. And there's some stories in the book as well about some other ones. These are like beneficial silos, helpful for emergencies. Sometimes these just pop up naturally. You have a production incident, people come together, make some changes, go back. They're not waiting for the sprint planning or something like that.
Yeah.
These are just shorter based teams. So helpful for emergencies, helpful to catalyze new product development. So there's some descriptive examples in the book of when I noticed this type of pattern. And again, it's the different examples that call out the pattern.
Thank you. And you went into lots of different examples. There's actually a chapter in the book for each of your patterns, the isolation pattern, the merging pattern, the switching pattern. You even have a chapter in the book on anti-patterns. And for some of the people listening in who maybe haven't read the book yet, what would be some of the anti-patterns to watch out for, Heidi?
Yeah, one of them is like, I think I call it the percentage anti-pattern in here, where you have people that are spread across multiple teams and managed by a project manager, and they're like, work on this. You work with this team 10%, this team 15%, this team 30%. Mm. All the percentages don't necessarily add up. And so you're like a member of all these multiple teams at once, and maybe you're joining and switching from them. And that, in my experience, is a recipe for some really challenging times for people. Mm. I think also there's stories in here about when you have a team that you believe is a high performing team, they're delivering value at an acceptable cadence. It seems like an enjoyable experience, and they're delighting the customers, for instance. And you try to spread out that high performance by switching people off of that team. That there's a story in there from a CTO that I worked with that it didn't quite go so well. And then the irony is that later in that company at a different division, a director tried the same thing and didn't quite work. I'm not saying bust up your teams tomorrow. It's the solution to every problem. It clearly is not. This is a very nuanced thing. This is not a method to install. This is not a framework to adopt. It's stories from the trenches. Your teams are going to change. You can recognize some patterns and get good at it, get better at it. There's some tactics for getting better at it. It's a natural occurrence.
I noticed in the book as well, not only did you talk about dynamic reteaming, but you talked about reteaming at a kind of a team of teams level. You referred to tribes, for example. And I'm imagining that involves a lot of planning.
Most definitely. There's stories there. The word tribe was one from Spotify. There's a story from Christian Linwall about a larger group of people who were together in this team of team structure that they called a tribe. Other companies I've been at call them divisions or colleges, for example, these groups of teams. And they decided to split them up in a different fashion and do a deliberate sort of reteaming or reorg. And so there's a chapter in my second edition that has some tactics about going about these large scale changes. They're hard to do. They're particularly risky. And it requires a lot of patience and over communication in order to have success. And I think also, like the example in the book from Spotify, Christian talks about how they visualized their reteaming on a series of whiteboards and then had conversation after conversation with the team members. And it helped inform and iterate on the solution that they were trying to create for their future team structure. I think it always helps to include people as best you can into these conversations. It's very challenging work to do.
And it's not just reteaming, it's also changing the, if you're in the office, changing the office space, because you made the distinction between being co-located and co-seated. So actually sitting near each other, if it's all distributed, it matters less, but that takes a lot of planning and people can be quite sensitive about where they sit, can't they?
Yeah, I think if you're in an office environment and typically people want to sit with their teams, and if you change the teams, it has implications on the physical space. And sometimes other people are involved. Sometimes you can't just move the desks. Sometimes people are moving from one space to the next. You might need to coordinate with your IT department. It's not necessarily so easy.
Yeah, indeed. And yeah, there's lots of tips and tricks in here. You've even got, if you're getting ready for an event, you know, what you need to have ready, all the tips and tricks and so on, and what you need to do. So I've really done a lot of thinking about this. And you even have, you mentioned this earlier, team calibration sessions, which I'm guessing is about, you've done the reteaming now, but you're maybe trying to, well, literally recalibrate in terms of, are we okay? Is everything fine? How am I feeling? That type of stuff. Is that where it's coming from?
Yeah. I think even for teams that decide, let's say the team decides it's too big and it wants to split into two teams, I think it helps to talk about the split. It helps to have closure. Let's celebrate some of the things that we did together as a large team and go through that transition. There's a great book I reference in here by William Bridges that talks about managing transitions. And really, it relates to grief cycles in some ways, and saying goodbye and getting closure. And then you start anew. I guess we can take this back to the eco cycle from the beginning. So you've created destruction, you're splitting into the two, you're getting up to the renewal. So when are we ready to start again? And how are we going to kick off or start our teams? So chapter 13 talks about this whole space, and there's activities that you can do so the people know each other a bit. There's a story of our team activity in here. I really love it, where you could actually do it with that large team and you can make a shared timeline with some of the milestones that have happened when you were a large team and the accomplishments that you had, when people joined, when people leave. You could tell the story and the history of your team. And then you get to start again. And now you're this smaller team. So who are the people on the team? It's like people, work, workflow, code base. How do you want to organize your work? What kind of process are you going to apply if you have the freedom to choose? What are each of your communication preferences and such? There's a variety of activities to try to like kickstart those teams so that they can focus on the work. Really maybe plan for relationship. People can talk about, this is the way I like to work. If we get in conflict, here's how I'd like to get feedback, all sorts of things like that to reduce risk in terms of team dynamics.
You also, near the back of the book, the end of chapter 13, refer to chapters, guilds, communities, that type of thing. And it reminds me of something that I say to people quite a lot, that I use the metaphor of cake when I talk about teams. Let's say it's software, right? There's a birthday cake downstairs, actually. There's a sponge at the bottom. There's jam in the middle. There's sponge on top and a little bit of icing on top. And so you got different layer. So it might be front end, middleware, back end teams, things like that. And so I call them layer of cake teams. And then slice of cake teams would be where they can cut through the whole cake and you get a little taste of everything kind of thing. And I often say to people that actually a lot of people talk about moving from layer of cake teams to slice of cake teams, but we have to be careful as well about metaphorically throwing out the baby with the bathwater, because there are some benefits to layer cake teams, like people understanding what they're working on and so on and so forth. And so what a lot of people do when they move to slice of cake teams, if they do some organization redesign, for example, they use communities to kind of preserve the prior order, if you like. So almost like layer of cake communities. And I'm curious, is that something you've seen, Heidi, in your experience? Or what kind of communities have you seen? What have been the good ones? And what would be things that you'd maybe encourage people to avoid in relation to communities?
So I've worked, what did you call it? The vertical one in layers?
Slice of cake team, which we
cut through. Yeah, I've worked a lot in my career on slice of cake teams. I also worked in the very early days, the layer of cake teams.
Yeah.
That would then integrate work together. And in both cases, we shipped products and got work done.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely more in vogue to work in slice of cake teams.
Yeah.
Sometimes people have identities with the layers of cake, like front-end engineering, and they get together in a guild and they talk about their community of practice. And I think that's fine. I think that's great. People want to hone their craft and then they go back to their slice of cake team and they have some greater alignment. I think open space, having like internal open spaces where people can solve an organizational problem together and then form like a conference schedule, they can find the layer of cake interests that they all might have, and then they can get together as a group. We're talking about groups at the beginning, and then maybe go back to their slice of cake team and bring some other ideas. Yeah.
Thank you,
Heidi. It's nice to be working on a slice of cake and delivering customer value at a regular cadence and not have to wait for a big batch integration later. That's a lot riskier and things take longer. So we don't really do that so much anymore unless we need to for some reason. We want to work on those. We want to have some thin slices of cake that we deliver out at a really acceptable cadence to our internal stakeholders and our customers.
Yeah, that's something that is troubling me a little bit. There's a trend where people are talking about cognitive load, which I get, and that people shouldn't be overwhelmed. But I wonder sometimes as well, cognitive load can be used as an excuse not to learn. I wonder if people can, you give people words and sometimes they might say, well, okay, we're doing architecture, so we're the enabling team for a blah, blah, blah value stream. But actually the learning isn't really part of what's going on. So it's interesting what people do with words, isn't it? And how people apply things in practice.
Yeah, I think it is. I try not to get too hung up on them. It's really about, can we work together? Can we delight our customers and get the value out the door
and
have a good work-life balance and succeed together? How can we help each other? That kind of thing.
And you mentioned very briefly at the end of the book as well about measurement, something that a lot of people struggle with. You referred to the Accelerate book, a fabulous book based on the state of DevOps research and so on, where they focus on lead time, for example, how quickly can you get something done? But they also have some countermeasures as well in terms of quality, how quickly can you recover and stuff like that. How often do you see people using measurements, what they recommend in the Accelerate book?
We used it at the last company that I was at and had a team that was created to report on these metrics. And so ideally, if you're doing that in your company, you have a feedback loop and you talk about what are you learning from applying these metrics?
Yeah.
The metrics that I really like are a little bit before that. So there's these delivery metrics, but the metrics before that, if you visualize your workflow and agree to pursue incremental improvement, the Kanban approach from when you start an idea to when you deliver, it happens before the code commit. From my experience, from the time that you check in code to when it's delivered is one place where people measure. But there's a lot of stuff that happens before that. And there's a lot of delays that can happen at this kind of upfront part of your workflow. So like product discovery, talking to customers, understanding the features, getting things ready, et cetera. Like all of that needs to get visualized. And I really like approaches described by Dan Vicanti and Prateek Singh Dan's book, Actionable Agile Metrics. We use that at my company. So we want to try to instrument our teams so that the teams have data that they reflect on. Yeah, how long does it take when something started to when it's delivered? So it's a different kind of lens at this. It's useful, I think, for teams to reflect on. If you can get to a certain sense of stability with your cycle time, maybe you can use it to forecast when you think your work might be done, because people need to have a good strategy for answering the question, when is it going to be done? You have to inform your stakeholders, in some cases, your customers. And I find that those methods are quite useful.
I'm lucky enough in two of my clients to have, actually three of them, to have lots of flow data. So we can see the stability of our flow, how much work is going out versus how much work is coming in. And if you take out all the noise, maybe you just do it even by quarters, because you have different types of work, different baskets of work coming in all the time. There is stability and we can see throughput is stable. And aging is the big thing to worry about, isn't it? How old is the work that you're working on? Are you juggling stuff? Are you finishing stuff in a different order to when you started them, kind of thing? And it's a really interesting topic, because what I come across in one of my clients in particular is they have no shortage of flow analytics and metrics and so on. But what's happening is they're passing work to other people down the value chain, if you like. They use the word expression value chain. And the people at the next downstream, if you like, have different bosses in a different hierarchy with different priorities. So the work goes across, it just ages for like forever. And that's disheartening for people, isn't it? Yeah. So I've been taking a leaf out of Jim Benson's book, which is ask people what's frustrating them and try to surface that with the executives so that we are trying to really solve problems for teams. Because even if we just tell people, it's not your fault, we understand that they feel guilty sometimes when their flow isn't as good as maybe it could be, because some of their flow is actually outside of their domain. So it brings me to my last question, which is about teams, because Klaus Leopold has a lovely expression that agility is not a team sport, it's a company sport. And Pia Maria Tharian has a lovely expression where she says, telling a flower to grow has little utility, because the flower isn't just going to grow, it needs an environment in which it can grow. And do you think, Heidi, that we might be overplaying our hand a little bit about teams? Is there something else we need to also do to ensure that we're successful together, that we can really build really good things and have really happy customers?
Teams don't work in complete isolation. You're part of a system, a larger system. So
yeah.
You know, this stuff is hard. Nobody's alone. People need to work together, need to work towards company goals, customer goals, personal goals. Yeah.
So Heidi, this has been a wonderful book for going through dynamic reteaming. Do you have anything else going on at the moment? Have you got anything cooking, any new books coming or new initiatives that you're thinking about right now that you're okay to disclose?
I've been VP of engineering for a year at an insurance startup called Kin Insurance. So I'm very focused on my work there. And who knows? Yeah, I give talks from time to time at conferences, talk on podcasts. So we'll see what comes. Right now, I'm very much in the trenches and trying to learn and do the best job I can. So
fantastic. Thank you so much. You'll have lots of more case studies and information for more interviews and another book, I'm sure, sometime in the future. Thank you so much, Heidi Helfand, for coming on the Exagility podcast.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
If you would like your voice message to be featured on a future podcast episode, please leave a voice message at anchor.fm/xagility/message. That's anchor.fm/xagility/message. Thank you.